to the Retail Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Darius Wassefi, and today I'm speaking with Melissa Pigas, SVP and Head of Sales at the company called MPP Global. How are you today, Melissa?
Doing really well, Darius, and thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you for joining the podcast. What does MPP Global do?
MPP Global is a subscription management platform company. We've been around for nearly 20 years now. And we help customers in the TV, sport, publishing, digital media, and retail space really manage and scale and grow their subscription businesses.
Subscriptions are the holy grail any business. If you can get people to subscribe to your service and keep paying for it at the renewal time, you're going to have a pretty successful business. What are some of the challenges for retailers to get into subscriptions, and how does MPP help?
Absolutely. If you think about why a retailer wants to move in the direction of subscriptions, subscriptions are really about establishing a relationship with your customer, knowing them, predicting their needs, and having that recurring business. And so that recurring business, I think, from the financial perspective is what's really enticing about it. But in the first iteration of subscription businesses, it was very sort of binary. A customer either chose to establish an ongoing financial relationship with you, or they didn't. And for a retailer or any business, that can be sort of scary, right? Because you're either converting or you're not. And so what our platform is really helping businesses do is have a conversation with their customer. And so our goal and really what our platform supports is putting the right offer in front of the customer at the right time in their journey. And what we mean by the journey is that every customer across your site is at different stages in terms of their engagement with your brand, how bought in they are to you and your services and your products. And so wanting to understand those cues to say, okay, are they ready to transact? How do they want to transact? And if they're not ready yet, how do we continue to drive engagement to push them towards transaction? And then, you know, at MPP Global, we really believe that it's not just about the subscription payment. It's about the journey to the payment and beyond. So after they've chosen to become a customer of yours, how do you keep them engaged? How do you retain your customers and minimize churn?
The challenge with subscriptions, of course, is not only the initial subscription, as you mentioned. Every time that the member has to renew, you have to prove your value to them again. So it's a continuous process. From what you mentioned, we're moving from a subscriptions 1.0 to a subscriptions 2.0 now, or maybe beyond that.
I think we're moving towards another level of intelligence in subscriptions, and really savvy digital marketers are looking at their technology stack and saying, okay, how can I have a conversation with my customers at scale? How do I understand what they need from me, what's working and what isn't working, and really fostering that relationship? Because the core of subscription is all about knowing your customer. You know, that's what our tools enable marketers to do. We like to think of ourselves as a subscription management platform that was really built for the digital marketer. So walking, you know, empowering them with the tools to do everything from identifying the anonymous user, you know, driving enough value to get them to convert to a known user, engaging them with what offers and products and services are going to be most compelling, giving them the easiest and most frictionless way to convert, both as we think about payment experience and payment types that we support, as well as that omni-channel experience and being able to support payments that are going to make sense for the end user across the different digital channels as well, and then keeping them engaged to make sure that we're keeping churn down. So following the customer life cycle and really bringing together that breadth of tools all in one pre-integrated product.
So let's walk through a use case. Let's say a company, a retailer has been in business for a few years. They want to get into the subscription side of business and try that. What's the process that you would go through with them?
Absolutely. So today companies have more data than they've ever had about how their stores are operating, about customer data. And so very often, and I think a lot of this conversation that we're having is actually with some grocery retailers. And for a very long time, you know, they've been offline, they've been in store, and have not been subscription based. And so the first thing that you can do is look historically across your products, whether you're a grocery retailer or fall across any category, and really understand what is your core offering, what really drives repeat business. So a good example, if you're a grocery retailer, is that people are always buying bread, milk and eggs. If you're a clothing retailer, it might be that people are coming back to buy the staples, buy the basics. And so that in and of itself, if you can understand what products are driving repeat business, and then also how often are people coming back to purchase these products, that in and of itself presents an opportunity to have that ongoing relationship to and really secure that recurring business. That way your customers are doing price comparison each time and potentially going to a different retail outlet.
Just to go into that a little bit deeper, so the mm-hmm. two main requirements really are what products mm-hmm. can be repeat business, you know, products, purchases, mm-hmm. and then the frequency.
Right.
You can put that into like a formula exactly. to see, does this even make sense for us or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great way to embrace, if you're a business that traditionally hasn't done subscriptions, to really embrace subscriptions, as opposed to on the other end, what we've seen retailers do is say, well, subscriptions is super interesting, so I'm just going to start sending, you know, stand up a service where I can send you a box full of stuff every month. And That's great. We've seen that work really well in the beauty space where customers want to try something new. But there is an interesting opportunity in terms of, you know, the products that you're already offering that's going to be less about trying something new and more about what's bringing them back time and time again. So, you know, this isn't one size fits all, but it is an interesting strategy. On the operational end, why this is really great is because in the case of a grocery retailer, for example, they're not having to spend valuable space in their brick and mortar for goods that they know their customers want to buy on a recurring basis, so they can make sure that they're fulfilling that and actually use their physical spaces to drive more experiences, to drive discovery, to really showcase new brands and new products, but also help to reduce, you know, a retailer's carry cost.
What are some of the challenges that the Kroger's and the Safeway's and Albertsons are facing as opposed to like the new online companies that are getting into the same business?
Really just embracing that change across the organization and really having to acknowledge that what they have a leg up on the competition is that they've had these longstanding brands, they have a relationship with their customer, and they're sitting on top of a ton of data, and really understanding how they activate all of these assets that they have to drive digital transformation across their business.
Is there resistance in these companies to this?
Doing new things can always be a bit scary, but keeping a pulse on what's going on with grocery, it seems as though they are very optimistic and excited about the opportunities to evolve their business moving forward. So I think there is always a bit of resistance around, you know, changing the way that we've always done things. And is that going to have an immediate shock to the business? And, you know, what does that mean for revenue in the short term? And what sorts of investments do we have? What does it mean for our, you know, capital expenditures and operating expenses? More or less, if you look at a lot of the literature that's out there, looking at the conferences that are popping up that are all about this evolution and innovation in the grocery space. So I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but you can see the tides turning, and I'm really excited about what's next.
Do you actually have like current grocery clients that use the suite?
Grocery is one of our sub verticals under retail. When we think of retail, we think of consumer services. So digital services that really borrows from our long history of working with digital companies, because there's some really great things you can do around a digital offering in terms of engagement and how you meter access. Grocery is definitely a sub vertical for us, Internet of Things as well. And then subscription retail, traditional subscription retail box subscriptions is also one. Grocery, I think, is the newest one. And so we do have some beta cases that we're working with that we can't exactly name just yet, but you know, we're really excited about how they've been so proactive to embrace, you know, technology and figure out how they can use it to have a better relationship with their customers. But, you know, as we think about the retail vertical, there's many different sub verticals under there that we serve.
So what products from your experience are best for subscription?
That's a loaded question. when I think of that, right, there's the staples that your consumers are constantly buying. So we talked a little bit about, you know, if you're a clothing retailer, maybe it's your basics. It could be, you know, your core basket of groceries, your core goods that you always go to a pharmacy to get. But on the other hand, there are those products where we see, you know, there is a trend for consumers wanting to discover and try new things. So we've seen the success of many, you know, beauty boxes, and that can be makeup, that can be fragrances, because these are goods that we see consumers have a, you know, proclivity to want to discover what's new. So looking at instances and that type, for example, a subscription box for outerwear probably isn't going to work.
Or furniture,
as well,
maybe.
As, exactly, or furniture, right? So those are goods that people probably aren't buying with a ton of renewal, but most companies have a lot of data about their customers to be able to answer those questions. And then anecdotally, you can also look at just, your day-to-day, what are the things that you buy on repeat? So these services popping up that are enabling people to effectively sign up for a subscription where they can grab lunch every day from, a network of restaurants. So there's a ton of, opportunity to look at the rhythm of your customers' daily lives and understand, where there's the best opportunity to develop that relationship and have an ongoing sort of transaction with them.
Okay. So beauty definitely is where there's been a lot of success. Grocery and staples, definitely. Clothing is also an area that there have been some success, but works better for ladies, I think, than for men. So.
Absolutely. There are details that make a difference. Clothing, in my opinion, is always going to be a bit of a tricky one, just especially when you look at things like return rates for clothing. It's hard to have a box for clothing because I could really like an article, but it might not suit me. It might not fit me. And so that's not something that we think of in an automated, I always want a new thing. And, based on my preferences, what I get, I'm more or less going to be happy with. That's really tough to crack because you're trying to solve for discovery of new brands, premeditating new needs and ideas and trends, and then also really trying to solve for fit for your individual customer. But, I think there's a lot of interesting things in the consumer goods space as well. I think when we talk about groceries, there's a little bit of overlap, but you probably have a cup of coffee every day. You're probably buying goods from the pharmacy with regular occurrence. Some of us have prescriptions that we're taking on an ongoing basis. Looking at the rhythm of our lives, I think there's a lot of interesting opportunities, especially, when you think about IoT. So there's so many new hardware and things coming out, and there will be necessarily services that you run through that hardware. So if you think of digital assistants and the connected home, there are so many services that you'll need to pay for on an ongoing basis. And again, more data that they're able to collect about your needs as well as a result.
Let's dig in a little bit deeper into the IoT side. When you say IoT for subscriptions, are you talking about the process of getting that set up for IoT companies or like the actual products?
It could be the actual product. So a really great example is in Europe. We're working with a car park, and people traditionally have had these fobs that they use to park their cars when they're working or going home, and they would have to top it up pretty regularly. But now they can sign up for subscriptions and actually have these sort of digitally connected sensors that know that they should have access to park or not. Similarly, we know that the connected home is very popular. It's that you think about things like your home security service, maybe your locks or things like that. And so there's so many services that are now run through those devices that present an opportunity for customers to be paying for those on an ongoing basis, right? For the life of the time that they're using that hardware, they're going to need the digital service to support it.
Home security, it's been a subscription business for a long time. What we're talking about is making it more intelligent, of course, with IoT. The potential for smart home or connected home to be able to use IoT to detect type of maintenance and services or products that are needed in the home and mm-hmm. provide it without the owner initiating. Let's
Absolutely.
Say, for example, like plumbing, the fridge, it notifies somebody before the owner even knows about it. And then in order to do that, the companies need to have their suite of technologies already set up. The eSuite provides the billing, revenues and billing from, I'm looking at the list of features on the website.
The core of what we do is that payment, the recurring payment. But the suite of product that we offer, it's all about how do you get that customer to the payment and how do you keep them engaged after. And so it would be wonderful if, every time a customer visited your digital domain, they made the choice to transact right away, but that's not often the case. And so we give businesses the tools to really trial out different business models because a customer base, the proclivity to transact will be different. Some customers will say, I want to pay monthly, I want to pay annually, I only want to pay for what I use, or I'm not really sure about this brand and you're offering, I'd only like to pay for one or two or five, installments of your product or your service. And so what we do is effectively give the businesses these tools at scale to have a conversation with that customer one-on-one and to be able to transact with that customer in the way that the customer wants, again, across different digital domains using the payment types that make the most sense. And then after they're on board and receiving products and using services, being able to track engagement and premeditate, you know, if they are going to be a churn risk. So the payment is at the core of what we do, but we've definitely provisioned a lot of tools for digital marketers to really take the customer on the journey to the payment and beyond to keep them engaged.
You don't do fulfillment, right?
We do not do fulfillment. We integrate with whoever the customer's fulfillment vendor of choice. If it's publishing, their local and regional fulfillment vendors for retailers, it could be, you know, Amazon fulfillment or something else. So we do integrate into other third-party systems to make sure that we can route those appropriate messages, you know, throughout the stack.
You also plug into the commerce platform, right?
We do.
Do you support most of the top commerce platforms or is there a special one that you work with?
We support right now integrations into Demandware, Magento, Shopify, and you know, we learn more from our customers. And so being really responsive to their needs. We've also done integrations for customers as we find out about new platforms that are gaining popularity.
And of course, I'm assuming everything is done by APIs.
So. Our platform is built on open APIs. Seeing a lot of consolidation in e-commerce, programmatic marketing platforms, really embracing commerce. And I think for those businesses, it makes a lot of sense wanting to be able to track all the way from the first, digital interaction and engagement with a customer all the way through to the purchase. That's really going to empower marketers to make really great decisions for their businesses and have better insights. And they're very complementary services, so that makes a ton of sense. So we're seeing, more consolidation in technology within the technology stack as well. That means that for the customer, especially on the back end, it's much easier for them to manage because all of a sudden the number of vendors that they have to integrate is going to shrink.
Right. Right. Assuming the integration happens after an acquisition properly inside the company.
Right. Yes. That's a big assumption.
Yeah. That's always a challenge. So I see that you do a lot of work with TV solutions as well.
Yes, we do. So, digital media, when we think of digital media customers, it's publishing. Publishing breaks down into newspaper, B2B publications, more consumer-facing titles, so B2C magazines and glossies. And then there's also TV, both, pay TV operators that want to go over the top, dedicated sort of OTT SVOD offerings, like a Sling or a Hulu or a Netflix, as well as sports. We're seeing a lot of rights owners in sports, specifically in the tier two and tier three space, wanting to monetize not only games, but, exclusive content they might have, like practice, content, special player videos. And other things like that. And so with digital products, much like digital services, there's a lot of really interesting things we can do around how our customers are consuming your service, all about engaging them and getting them bought into your offering. And so as we mentioned, we can do things like metered access, monthly access, annual contracts, and really understanding and taking cues from the customer. Okay, what content or subcategory of content are you most interested in? What's going to be the most valuable way for you to have this financial relationship ultimately with the provider of this digital content? And for our customers, that's great. That gives them so many opportunities to engage and build their brand and build value, as opposed to, in the early days where it was, well, as soon as you went to the domain, there was a hard paywall and the customer either paid and got access to content or they didn't. So now we have a lot of tools to really help them convert that user, which is great, especially as the marketplace is becoming more and more crowded with these digital media, and TV and movie and sports services as well. So we're really helping them build their brand and differentiate themselves.
The actual use case of publishing and news, like let's say news by itself is of interest to me. A lot of publications are moving towards that subscription model.
Absolutely.
And they have the paywalls, but it's not a good experience for users to go through and have to manage like 10 different subscriptions. Do you see anybody bundling things together? So you get one subscription and it handles your favorite newspapers?
There are services out there that do content aggregation. Absolutely. And, you know, you might have a service for the news enthusiast, for the sports enthusiast that gives them access to great content across titles. I also think we're seeing a lot of publishers acknowledge, right, that there's a lot of choice for customers in terms of, you know, where they want to consume different types of content. If a customer says, I don't want to have five subscriptions to all these different titles, maybe the right way for them to approach that customer is to do things like micropayments. So then only pay for our content, which you consume. This is something that, you know, the Winnipeg Free Press does. And we'd actually launched micropayments for them. So you're right. In the news, in the media space, in the publishing space, they are moving towards a subscription business model that gives them more predictability in terms of their revenue stream. But, you know, I'm also hesitant to say that one size fits all. It really depends on your business and the way that you implement a, you know, paid offering for your customer. It's going to have to be aligned and make sense for your brand. I know there was a ton of news not too long ago. I read a few articles about, I guess, Bloomberg put up a new paywall. And, you know, and you went from content that previously was free to now content that you have to pay for. And, you know, what we hear from our customers in terms of best practices is that people have a lot of choice in terms of what they're paying for, but you have to drive value for their money. If you have a freemium model, or if you're looking to stand up a paywall, what are you going to give your customers to really drive value in their mind for the service that they're receiving? What's going to be new and different and exceptional that they're suddenly paying for? In terms of having to manage them, I'm sure you're talking about the friction of like signing up and paying. And for our customers, in terms of how they manage that payments friction, it's that, you know, if your customer is always accessing your content through your native application, right, then you should be able to, you know, take their payments using Apple Pay or have them paid iTunes, but then have those entitlements managed centrally. So that way, if they do go to the desktop, there's also an experience they can enjoy. You know, for other media companies, you know, they also understand, well, how does an offering, you know, if someone's accessing my content on like Roku versus their phone, you know, are there different ways that we tier that? But there are a lot of really elegant solutions to make sure that your customer is not constantly having to deal with a sign wall and paywall, especially maybe on a device that's not optimized for that experience. So it's really all about, you know, having a great omni-channel strategy and really knowing your customer.
I completely agree that you need to make money for the content. Good content doesn't just grow on trees. Everybody in that cycle has been really under a lot of pressure, and I'm not happy about the fact that the quality of journalism is going down because people are just used to getting it for free now.
Right. So I think it's you've hit all on all the right points. As consumers, we need to acknowledge that great journalism costs money to produce. And it's really important what we expose ourselves to, what we read, whether consciously or unconsciously, it has such a big impact on the way that we view the world and the way that we think that, you know, we should want good quality content. I can see a lot of parallels to a lot of the, you know, the dialogue about fast food versus like organic food and, you know, one being cheaper than the other, right? If you really think about it, you can see a lot of parallels there. And so first, as consumers, we need to acknowledge that what we read, what we consume is super important, and good journalism costs money. And then secondarily, I think there's also a really interesting opportunity for editors to say, you know, we've had this offering that's been free for so long. We've really built our brand, you know, and have people coming to read this content. But how can they really embrace new media types? So we've seen really great things that some publishers have done, like embrace, you know, premium models. So some of their content is still free as they're trying to build their brand and engage with new readers, but you know, really using the insights around what types of content and what forms of content, whether it's video or digital print, are really driving conversion, are causing people to want to pay for that access, you know, and really doubling down on different media types and different content types. So again, there's a ton of data that publishers are sitting on that they can really use to help them approach the problem really creatively. It's definitely a challenge. There's no one-size-fits-all bullet. It really depends on your brand and your customer base. But I'm really excited about, you know, what we'll see and how we see publishers getting really creative, whether it's through, you know, signing up for services for and acknowledging that some of their customers have a bundle of content they want to get from different publishers, as well as saying, you know, what are new content types and content formats that we can offer to really, you know, reassure that customer to make them feel good about, you know, paying and being a patron of our services.
So let's talk a little bit about yourself. Really interested to see how you navigated your career to get to where you are, and what do you actually do right now in the day-to-day? So maybe this is some good feedback for people that want to get into sales and strategic partnerships.
I have a really great role. I enjoy it. I work with a really wonderful team. And so, you know, I've built my career really working in the e-commerce SaaS technology space. And before that, just generally in the SaaS space. So learning a lot about how you build a great product and product innovation. I'm in sales enablement really early on in my career, and I first got started in e-commerce actually at a company called Spree Commerce. They were an open source Ruby on Rails platform. Retailers, well loved by retailers over the world and still love today. So Goop is on Spree, Bonobos was on Spree, at one point ModCloth was on Spree, Stella and Dot was on Spree, you know, Blue Bottle Coffee, Casper, Loot Crate. So really some wonderful, wonderful brands out there. And I joined to really build out their partner ecosystem. So from everything from defining what is a partner program to who should we partner with, and then actually, you know, writing the contracts and recruiting the partners and managing both the channel sales side of things, as well as product integration partnerships that really helped build the value in the platform. And it was really wonderful. I had a great experience after that. I worked with Curate on partnerships. They were more in the content marketing space. So understanding, you know, which partnerships were going to be critical to help retailers embrace different social platforms, both for, you know, organic growth, as well as, you know, part of their ad strategies, part of their paid strategy. And then for me, MPP Global was a great next step because it really rounded out my e-commerce experience. The first part of my career was really focused on the sale of physical goods and how you sell physical goods online. I really loved that MPP really embraced the sale of digital goods as well. And so rounding out that experience, really understanding what the technology stack looks like for that group of customers and working with some great partners. So some of the partners that I get to work with are Microsoft, you know, and they have a phenomenal team and a phenomenal product. So, you know, we borrow components from their AI offering, from machine learning offering. Our platform is hosted in Azure, working with other players in the video space like, you know, Uyala as well, all of the e-com platforms that we integrate with as well. So it was a great opportunity for me to also bring my experience and knowledge of, you know, the sale of physical goods to really help MPP embrace retail as a vertical. And so when I first joined MPP Global, I was solely focused on partnerships. So we work through our partners, both on the product integration side, best of breed integrations that help customers really get to market and leverage the, you know, the best tools to support their business, as well as leveraging partners to help us scale our sales operations and our product and marketing operations as well. And then a short while after I joined, then took over, you know, responsibility for sales as well as partnerships in the Americas. So everything in the Western Hemisphere. And so I have the profound privilege of leading an amazing sales team across our retail and TV and sport and publishing verticals, and working with some wonderful partners and, you know, in the Western Hemisphere as well, as taking all those best practices and really being the voice of the market internally, taking that back to the team so we can understand, you know, what do we have to do to keep up and actually help our customers get ahead? What is the market asking for? How are the markets evolving?
Wow.
So when I think of, and it's been a terrific ride. And typically when I talk to people about, you know, my career, I think there are a few things. You can have a really great career in technology without actually being a developer. I think very often when we talk about careers in technology, people think they have to know how to write code. I definitely understand how platforms work, how APIs work, and I'm comfortable enough with that vernacular to navigate conversations with our partners and customers alike. But, you know, there are many important paths at every company, and so not all of them are super technically focused. And then the last is that, you know, I didn't study technology in undergrad. I went to Georgetown and I studied, you know, government and economics, sociology and philosophy. I just loved being a student and doubled down on those subjects. And so the most important thing is about how you teach yourself to learn and to learn new things. What served me really well in my career has been asking questions, learning how to ask better questions, but then also, having the courage to take on stretch goals. I think having just being really ambitious, and I find that the harder I work, the luckier I get. And it's also been a very awesome opportunity for me to also, drive diversity at the company, that I'm not being one of the only women on the executive management team, as well as one of the only women of color at the company. And so, that diversity of experience is not only so important for the company and I think the day-to-day function of our operations, but it helps us, be more innovative, really understand and embrace the different experience of our customers, their end users, and making sure that we account for that in our product and in our marketing and in the way we sell and the way that we talk to the marketplace in general. So, be really creative with your careers. It's going to be as wonderful, and I think you can do as much as you can creatively think you can do. I think have the audacity of your dreams and take on.
Right.
I think take on new opportunities and be fearless. And, I do think the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yes. That's the truth of life. And, of course, some people think that luck has a major factor. And, being in the right place at the right time is important. But, mm-hmm. How many times have people been in the right place and at the right time and didn't materialize an opportunity? A lot more than right. people that have. So I think it's just that preparation and...
Preparation yeah. is key. And I think, grit. So you're going to hear a lot of no's in your life. I think we've all been in scenarios where you apply for jobs and you don't get them, or you pitch a customer, you don't get them, but all you really need is one yes. So, have the grit to persevere. All experiences should serve as some form of feedback that you use to make yourself better, to make your approach better, to make your knowledge of the market better. And, you really need one yes. So, just grit and hard work. And I think having a positive outlook as well. I mean, it in hindsight, it can sound really easy. In the thick of it, it doesn't always feel that easy. But I think especially working in the technology space, working in e-commerce, I like to feel that we're all cheering for each other. We all want to see each other succeed and do well. And so,
agreed. A rising tide will help us all. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
The concept that you mentioned, not the concept, the practice of diversity is actually very important, and it requires its own interview in of itself. Maybe we'll do it at some point. As a woman, that's in that role right now, how do we change this really to a significant degree?
I wish I had the answer to that. I think that's the question everyone's got a keen eye on. I think diversity is not just about gender or race. There's also, I think, socioeconomic diversity that's also really important. Just diversity of backgrounds in general. I've been really lucky in my career to actually have tremendous allies who were men and who were white men as well. And so I think at all levels and at all stages in life, there are great people out there who really recognize the importance of diversity. So I've had really great allies who have supported me. I stand on the shoulders of giants, and I'm so grateful for that. But I think we can all do good work to check our own biases. That as we go through our workday, as we make decisions, I mean, I can even think of in our hiring, right? There are a lot of companies who sometimes get inundated with candidates, and therefore they can take the approach and say, well, if you can't get a warm intro or if you're not recommended by someone, we're just going to shrink down our candidate pool by then not considering those, but understanding the bias in there, right? So if you think of from a racial and gender and socioeconomic, right, it's actually a privilege to be able to have someone who can intro you, especially if you're younger and getting started in your career. There are some wonderful measures that can be taken in hiring. And we all have a responsibility to hold ourselves to a higher standards in the workplace. So diversity is not just about how we recruit, but it's also about how we treat and interact with each other. And so having open dialogues, right, about, what what are the standards we want to hold ourselves to? How are we going to run the business day to day? And also understanding the diversity of experiences means that we also need to account for that in the development plans of our teams. And so, you know, how do we prepare people to take on leadership positions to really excel and navigate an organization that maybe traditionally has not historically been super diverse? So I think it's something we're all trying to figure out. And I really wish I had the answer, but I am lucky enough to work for a company where we're able to have very open and frank conversations. And more so than anything, we're really trying to learn from each other and be empathetic and be supportive. And so we don't have the answer, but we're committed to figuring it out together. And on the other hand, I also think it's really important, you know, if you're in an organization where that's not a goal for them, to really pull up and ask yourself, does the company that I work with, do they align with my own personal goals and beliefs? And sometimes, you know, you have to make hard decisions in the short term that will ultimately benefit you and your career in the long term, because, you know, we see headlines about where things go wrong, but, you know, I think there are a lot of great people and great organizations out there who want to see a tremendous amount of progress made. So I think it's really about finding the right fit, finding the right mentors. And I like to think that people want to be helpful. I have people who are younger in their career who reach out to me for help. And as much as I can, I'm very happy to give it. It's an important thing that we all should be focused on. Your customer base is super diverse. Just think about in retail, right? In terms of the diversity, in terms of people like socioeconomically who are patronizing your store, buying your products, if they're women, if they're represented by different races. And so those are, you know, there's so many interesting implications for, you know, how you market your products, how you sell your products, where you sell your products, you know, how you design your different customer experiences. And then also as customers, you know, as they become more conscious, right? What are the important things to market about what your business is doing and your values? Because we're also seeing trends that customers, you know, products that they buy are no longer about the utility of those specific products. It also says something about, you know, the group they belong to, the company that they really want to support.
As a society, we don't ask each other, like we don't ask a candidate what your race is or what color you are. But then at the same time, as an organization, be able to address all of our customers, all of our stakeholders. How do you, like, let's say as a retailer, if you don't know who your audience is, who your customers are, how do you manage to personalize your experience? Great conversations.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Darius. Looking forward to continuing the conversation and all of the, you know, the great dialogue around the trends happening both in commerce and I think in workplaces in general.